You're listening to Tech Talk Radio in your backyard and worldwide on the pod.
In the communication sector, there is a revolution taking place.
Look how far we've come. A third of the music released last year in this country was not even released on a CD.
Do you use a credit card online?
No, I live in Russia.
I'm concerned about the way the company's being run and the fiber to the node network.
Unless we can have clarity that we will not be subjected to further separation, we are not in a position to lodge an RFP bid.
You can't make it a technical game because the very people you're trying to protect are smarter than you.
We want to really change the world by making things so special, you've got to have it.
On air, on the internet, and on the pod, you're listening to Tech Talk Radio.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to this week's edition of Tech Talk Radio. I'm Andrew McComb. The trials and tribulations of technology in transit can be quite daunting for the uninitiated, or even the experienced, for that matter. Last week, I drove a couple of hundred kilometres down the Victorian coastline to the small holiday village of Inverloch. Not that the destination is relevant, it could have been any town in Australia outside of one of the main central business districts. Mobile communications is divided into two distinct components these days, mobile telephony and mobile data. If you're rich enough to be connected to Telstra, Australia's incumbent telecommunications provider, then chances are you won't have to worry too much about it. But if you're consumer savvy and conscious of the drain on the hip pocket, then chances are you're with a different provider. Even still, you may have two different providers, one for your mobile telephony and one for your mobile broadband. Since the launch of handsets such as the Apple iPhone, the BlackBerry and even Nokia's E71, data has become more of a necessity than ever before. After all, why invest in these smartphones which have been designed and built to deliver a vast range of internet services to the consumer on the go, if you aren't going to use what's on offer? Before the smartphone hit the market, telcos saw data over the mobile phone network as a bit of a cash cow. But in the past year or so, pricing for mobile data is becoming comparable to that of voice. Even the Telstra Rock of Gibraltar has budged ever so slightly in the past 12 months. But beware of the roaming display on your mobile phone, because this is where mobile data can become extremely expensive. Mobile data can be charged anywhere from 50 cents to several dollars per megabyte when you choose to use internet services on your mobile when roaming onto another carrier's network. Now, on the face of it, it doesn't sound too bad, but if you leave your handset on with applications like Google Maps, Skype, or Fring, then you may be in for some bill shock, especially if you're away from your home location for a while. Other processes that run on your smartphone, such as email clients, can also eat away at your mobile data plan. So the trick to travelling is turn off what you don't need, or at least change the settings to manual. At least that way, you'll know when and how much mobile broadband you're using. One final piece of advice, as mobile broadband gets faster, unless you have a substantial allocation of mobile broadband, never leave your laptop unattended with your broadband connected. I did on the weekend to find a substantial swag of my allocation consumed by a fairly sizable Windows update. Just as well, my account anniversary was only 2 days away.
This week on Tech Talk Radio,
former Qantas pilot and aviation guru Mark Mayer joins us live in the studio. Adam looks at mobile voice over IP, Microsoft to sell Windows 7 in Europe with no browser at all, Apple's Worldwide Developer Conference has concluded, and what have we learnt? And Telstra wants an independent telecommunications adjudicator to be set up. First up, though, here's the latest happenings in the world of technology for this week with Dr. Ron.
This is Tech Talk News.
This week on Tech Talk News, profits from cybercrime surpass the worldwide illicit drug trade. Software storage businesses not immune from the global financial crisis. Apple announces the new iPhone 3GS. Microsoft forays into the realm of antivirus software, and NASA reboots the Mars Reconnaissance Orbiter. Welcome to Tech Talk News. Attendees at the Australian High Tech Crime Conference in Sydney last week heard that cybercrime now generated over $100 billion globally a year, now making it more profitable than the illegal drug trade. The New South Wales Attorney General, John Hatzisturgos, told the conference that cybercriminals are often one step ahead of law enforcement agencies and take great delight in being so. The director of the Communications Law Centre at Sydney's University of Technology, Professor Michael Fraser, spoke on government radio last week and said that cybercrime was sophisticated, specialised, and that many people would not even know if their computer was infected.
Figures show that a lot of cybercrime is undetected. People are not even aware that their finances are being skimmed, or even if it is noticed, many cybercrimes are unreported.
One of the goals of the conference was to find ways to prosecute offenders across national boundaries. Professor Fraser likened the internet to a Wild West town, saying that it was naive to adopt the view that the internet should not be regulated or subjected to law enforcement. IT Wire reports that the global software storage market has declined for the first time in more than 5 years, with most companies in the market experiencing negative or very low year-over-year growth. The worldwide storage software market was reportedly hit with its first decline in 21 consecutive quarters of year-over-year growth in the first quarter of 2009, with revenues representing a 5% drop over the same quarter this time last year. An IDC spokesperson said that the overall storage software market was pulled down by the underperforming large companies that make up a bulk of the submarkets, but that once they started to recover, the entire market would be brought up with them. IDC also reported that EMC led the overall market with nearly 22% revenue share in the first quarter of 2009, with Symantec in second position with nearly 19% revenue and IBM in third position with 12% revenue share. Apple has announced the latest addition to its popular iPhone range, the 3GS model, running the new iPhone 3.0 software. Apple's Senior Vice President of iPhone Software, Mr. Scott Forstall, made the announcement last week at Apple's Worldwide Developer Conference in San Francisco. Mr. Forstall highlighted some of the 3.0 software's new features, including cut-and-paste, landscape keyboard and streaming API, as well as the ability to send and receive MMS messages and let users rent and purchase movies. Another long-awaited feature is tethering, which lets MacBook and PC users use the iPhone 3GS as a wireless modem. The letter S after the model name supposedly stands for speed, and the new device offers a new focus on application load times. According to Apple, the new device launches games, opens attachments, and runs JavaScript significantly faster than its predecessors. Pricing was announced at $199 for the 16GB model and $299 for the new 32GB model. The existing 8GB iPhone 3G will remain on sale, with its price dropping to just $99. The 3GS will be available for sale in the United States on the 19th of June, while other countries have been promised the device from the 28th of July. Microsoft last week announced that it would be making an antivirus product freely available to users of its Windows operating system. While Microsoft has made its anti-spyware product, Windows Defender, available for some time now, this is the first time that the software giant has released a free antivirus product. The antivirus software, codenamed Morro, will protect Windows-based systems against viruses and spyware, rootkits, and trojans, and will ultimately replace the Windows Live OneCare product. But the announcement has been criticised by antivirus experts. Senior Director of Product Management at Symantec, Mr. David Cole, said that Morro is essentially a stripped-down version of Microsoft's failed OneCare product. He also said that while it didn't offer adequate protection when it was payware, it would offer even less protection as freeware. Microsoft expects the product to be available by the end of 2009. And it seems that terrestrial computers aren't the only ones that need the occasional reboot. The Mars Reconnaissance Orbiter is currently running in what NASA describes as safe mode after an unexpected restart of its computer 2 weeks ago. Engineers have said that the spontaneous reboot was probably caused by a cosmic ray or solar particle hitting the spacecraft's electronics, causing an erroneous voltage reading. A NASA spokesman said that the flight team was cautiously bringing the orbiter back to normal operations, and that this was the sixth time since 2005 that the spacecraft had put itself into safe mode. I'm Dr. Ron, and that's your tech update for this week.
Previously on Tech Talk Radio.
Did you know this week is National E-Security Awareness Week?
This is what's created a bit of a ruckus.
There's two sides to that, though. I mean,
yeah, get a new password.
The world has gone mad.
Have you seen the fake Dr. Ron Twitter account?
Oh, no.
There's
cool.
one.
I want to subscribe.
Yeah, well, maybe not.
Google's answer to Wolf from Alpha.
Yes.
Google Squared.
Okay, good.
Please don't write your username and password on the same post-it note and then stick it to your monitor.
That's a good way of putting it.
You can do anything with statistics.
So far, they've...
even tell the truth.
I thought that was real.
No, that's not real.
Are you telling me that Adam's being followed by a fake ASIO account?
Adam might be being followed by ASIO, but they won't be using an account name that says ASIO.
All things to all men never quite works.
We're going to have to start scripting this show a bit more tightly because my head's starting to spin.
I know.
Entertaining, informative, and independent. You're listening to Tech Talk Radio. The panel on Tech Talk Radio.
It's that time of the week again. Good evening, everybody. Welcome to Tech Talk Radio. I'm Andrew McComb. Sitting across in front of me in the panel this evening, Dr. Ron is in, as per normal. JD is in. Dr. Graham is in. And we have a guest in this evening, as promoted last week. Mark Mayer is in. We're going to talk about aviation and things that should stay in the sky that don't and things that are on the ground that should get in the sky. So stick around. It's going to be fun. chat.techtalkradio.com.au is our somewhat lagging chat service this evening due to technical reasons. But other than that, come along and join us. Dr. Ron, how's your week?
Yeah, it's been good. I've been building flat pack furniture.
Yeah, I can see the panel on your head. You've got a flat part of your forehead at the moment.
From banging my head against the wall, is.
How many bits did you have left over after building, say, something out of a flat pack? You always end up with a few bits left over, don't you?
I think it's because they were included as spares. It seemed to go together.
That's a likely story.
I'm a glass half full sort of guy, Graham. I'm hoping that they're because they were provided as spares. But I have...
spares from IKEA.
Yes. I have now... What were we saying today on the telephone? Post IKEA stress disorder.
Yeah. Yes. You have to go and have a few...
PISD.
Yeah, that's it. You have to go and have a few good stiff ones afterwards to try and relax the thought of a flat pack. But anyway...
Oh, I think so.
How's technology gone for you? Has it been working for you?
Technology is good.
That's good. I've had a major... I've been building new servers during the course of the week. I'm migrating one of my main servers across to Windows Small Business Server 2008, which has been fun. And it works out of the box. Great.
Now, you're replacing an old Windows 2000 server,
yes.
Is that right?
One of my Windows 2000 boxes has been running for 9 years and decided, I said, it's time to retire.
9 years?
9 years out of Windows 2000. Hey, that's
a long time to have a server in production.
That was back in the days when you didn't have to authenticate and prove, you know, validate and all that sort of stuff. Remember that?
Yep, I remember that. Yeah. The good old days,
The good old days. So, yeah, I've had a fun week.
But isn't the installation process of SBS 2008 nice and smooth?
It is. Still takes as long, but it's nice and smooth, yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. I built it up on a brand new Intel device, singing, all dancing, lots of RAM and stuff. I was actually going to put it on a solid state drive until I realised just how expensive they were, because I figured that would be really good for it to boot off and you could stick all your applications on another old physical, you know, regular hard drive.
They have a limited number of read-writes, though, the solid-state drives.
Do they?
Yeah.
So I did well not going on a...
I think so at this stage of the technology. But,
that's good. I feel good.
Yeah.
Feel good. JD, you must be a buzz. All the new Mac stuff out of the Worldwide Developers Conference.
WWDC happened.
All sorts of wonderful things. New notebooks, new iPhones, new operating systems. You name it, it happened.
Cut and paste.
Cut and paste, yes, I'll be very happy when I get that official.
Yay.
Yay. Yay. And iPhones that go a little bit faster, except if you live in Australia, which is going to be...
Well, they'll still go twice the speed. It's just a matter of their connection.
But no network support. Well, one does, and they're not interested. But we'll talk about that later, too. Mm. Find that absolutely amazing. All right. Let's get underway. Dr. Ron, correspondence?
We had some problems with the podcast on iTunes during the week. There was a mysterious error 8006.
What's that? I did see that email, but I thought, no.
We had many reports of that. The best that I can do, an iTunes error 8006, is a file not found type error. That is, the host that is hosting it could not be found by iTunes. So I don't know why that was going.
I even remember to upload it this week. So
yeah, you did. It was good. There. Everyone who downloaded it directly was okay, and most iTunes users were okay. Just the select few for some reason.
There is an issue with Bluehost in the United States at the moment with the server which we host on. They're very slow, which is evident in the chat room this evening. So maybe that explains things. I've sent a few emails over to them, and we're not the only ones. So
the chat seems to be empty at the moment.
Oh, well, there's a few getting in there.
Are they?
Yeah, they're slowly getting in there. But, yeah, it might be one and the same.
Mine's showing I'm the only one there, so perhaps that's part of the problem.
No, there's more than just you there. Let me assure you of that.
Are you logged into the right chat room?
Not that chat room.
No. All right.
Damien says, "Hi, guys. There was a bit of a discussion last week about managing the multitude of passwords for everything we do online. online these days.
Yes.
In particular, the risks with identity theft and unauthorized access.
And post-it notes and passwords and on laptop screens.
And post-it notes on your screens, yeah. Exactly what Damien says. I used to be the diehard techie when it came to passwords and would rely on memory or my own cryptic method of storing them in written form, stored in my wallet, not under my keyboard. I've never liked or used any password storage offered by any of my browsers in the past, ever since using Firefox for the last 3 years.
I'm impressed.
I had not breached the subject. I beg your pardon. I had not broached the subject of a password manager either up until recently. Die Hard, though, was getting too hard for Damien. He found a product that works for Windows, Mac, and Linux called LastPass, which he said you can find at lastpass.com. This is a browser plugin. You set up an account and it provides a secure repository online in which to store your password data and keeps a copy on your local machine, encrypted, of course, he says, to allow offline access. This also gives you the ability to access your account's information anywhere you have internet access. Using it's pretty simple, says Damien. It'll trap the login data for you as if you're logging onto a site and reduces the need to remember many passwords. You can increase their complexity if you want to, and no, only you need to remember one password to access your repository.
Is that good? Well, he thinks it is.
He thinks it is. Damien thinks it is. I still go down the path of remembering everything, and I do rely on browsers as well to some extent.
Yeah, I've got my own algorithm in my head. I know how I create my passwords from certain things that are around me and dates and times and places. That seems to work reasonably well, with a slight variation for each particular place that I'm logged into.
You're putting a lot of trust in whoever runs LastPass, telling them all your passwords to everything.
Yes, that is one of the downsides, but we put a lot of trust in people like Google too, emptying our live story into places like Gmail and...
Yeah, but I don't tell Google all my passwords either.
No.
You just tell it one password.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And the password to Google. So, I mean, what happens if someone at LastPass isn't entirely on the up and up? It might just be, rather than the organisation, might be fine, but they might have an employee that's... decides to...
leaves under less than optimal circumstances.
Well, you would hope that they might have encrypted or something on their systems.
Might even be someone at their service provider who can get into the database back end that they're using.
Mm.
So, I don't know about that.
Well, I guess you've got to be a little bit discreet. You're not going to be putting your internet banking password on there, because that's one you'd have to commit to memory. You know, you do the get smart thing, write on a post note, then eat it.
Yeah. I'm very, very concerned about trusting people just a little bit too much here.
Okay. It works for Damien.
What if LastPass don't pay their hosting bill?
Well, your suspicions are noted.
What if the hosting provider goes out of business and the hosts are no longer there one day?
And even if it's just for a day.
It might not be LastPass's fault. It might be the hosting provider.
I know, but you've only got yourself to blame. You need to back it up somewhere else. Like every bit of data you do. You've got to back it up. You need two copies. One locally and the other not so local. Anything else, Dr. Ron?
That's all for this week.
Oh, good.
Feedback at techtalkradio.com.au if you'd like to send us a message. As Andrew said, you can also join us on the chat tonight. And JD, how's our television studio going?
We're up and running. Graham's black at the moment.
Is he?
Oh, however.
Oh, hello there, everybody. If you want to come and have a chat on the... where are we? Where's the URL again?
The URL is at ustream.tv. You can go to ustream.tv/techtalkradioau and click on the link that says go to show page. And you'll see us live. Even if you're not listening live, you can see an archive version of the show.
Fantastic. So wherever you might happen to be.
Someone's still got sound on.
Oh, yes. JD, so was the how would you say the Worldwide Developers Conference was? Did you give it a thumbs up, a 5 out of 10? Where did it sit on the satisfaction scale?
People seem fairly happy because there's some new laptops to play with.
Yeah.
There's a new phone coming out really soon in Australia, June 26, apparently. And the new operating system, both for the Mac itself, so Snow Leopard, is due to be released shortly, and OS 3 for the iPhone will come out very, very soon. So all around, most people are pretty happy. I noticed on some of the forums, the Mac forums in particular, the main complaint is, I have to wait an extra week beyond the US to get it in Australia. So that's the biggest whinge.
Yeah.
I think we're doing pretty well.
Where was Steve? Did he send a note or something?
A lot of people
were expecting him to sort of front there because he was back on deck, and I don't know. Does that mean anything, or
I don't think so.
No?
It's okay. A developers conference. It wasn't the Apple conference per se. So the theme really was around the operating systems. That's what the developers conferences are all about. But it gives Apple an opportunity to talk about their other technologies, their hardware technologies coming out, which obviously they've done now. So bit of an interesting move with the laptops. So they've had
What's the deal? What are we seeing? They're cheaper. There was a price cut, wasn't there?
A bit of a price cut.
Because someone realised that they were a tad expensive and they...
Yes. And a couple of the, not that they're that much cheaper, and some of the larger models are getting a speed bump as well, up to 3.06 gigahertz apparently. Mm-hmm. But the interesting thing is they brought out the MacBook, and I'm playing on a white one here myself, and then they brought out an aluminium version of the MacBook last time round. Well, they've decided to upgrade it, so even the smaller MacBook aluminium is now a MacBook Pro. So they've gone back to plastic white being the MacBook, and all the aluminium stuff is now the Pro version. What they've also done, though, with the upgrade of the 13-inch MacBook Pro now, is they've added FireWire, so it's now got the IEEE standard interface that Mac users know and love for high-speed data from video or data to hard drive.
Mm-hmm.
But they've removed the Express card slots and replaced them with SD card slots now, which is an interesting move for the smaller machines.
Yeah. SD cards being traditionally a portal for mobile broadband cards and things like that. Sorry, we're talking about the Express slots?
Yes.
Yeah, where you'd normally plug a mobile broadband card, and they put SD in there.
They put SD slots in instead.
Interesting. Maybe they're all going, they're thinking USB dongles for mobile broadband or something like that.
Maybe they are. Mm. There was some discussion that the future MacBooks actually might have 3G in them, so that would make a lot of sense.
Well, crystal ball stuff's good at these developers' conferences, isn't it? It gives probably the Mac people a bit of an idea what to do for next time.
So, Snow Leopard, the new operating system's due out in September.
Now, what's the difference?
Snow Leopard,
What's the difference between the current cat and the new cat?
Leopard versus Snow Leopard.
Yeah.
$14, apparently.
Oh, okay. I wasn't thinking pricing. I was thinking facilities, cut and paste.
In Australia, the upgrade is $14.95. How's that?
That's not bad.
That's pretty good. What's the difference? Well, they've finally dropped the PowerPC architecture. So those old Apple users like myself that have got G5s and G4s,
you can no longer put a cat on your box.
Can't use Snow Leopard anymore. And whilst the betas that came out didn't have any PowerPC code in them, everyone was saying, "Oh no, they'll build it in at the last minute." Well, they haven't. Now, what does that mean? It means that the footprint for the operating system is a lot smaller, so it doesn't use as much hard drive space because it doesn't have to have two sets of code. It also means that it's optimized for the Intel chipset and therefore runs faster as well. So there's a few features there. I think we've spoken about previously Grand Central, which is a multi-core threading application or background application to make use of multiple core processors like the Mac Pros have in them, and even the MacBooks and iMacs have in them. So that's due out shortly. There's a new version of QuickTime built into that. There's a whole lot of other upgrades, but essentially it's going to be optimized for the Intel processor now.
Okay. Battery life? Any news on that?
No huge news on battery life, to be honest. I haven't seen anything written about it. And we were probably alluding there to the iPhone 3GS.
Yeah, S for speed.
S for speed. It's going to be twice as fast in loading things and doing things. However, the processor, whilst it's not known all that well, the lovely people over at T-Mobile in Germany got a bit too carried away and put all the specs up on the website for a moment or two.
Oh, they were just doing a preload and someone took a snapshot, right?
Yeah. So,
Are they still Apple distributors?
I think they will be. They're pretty big.
Right.
I don't think they're going to get dropped immediately. Allegedly, the processor's got bumped from 412 megahertz to 600 megahertz. Mm-hmm. So it's not quite double the speed. But what they have done is doubled the RAM. So that will make a significant difference in the way the phone works.
Okay. What type of RAM is in these things? Is it fast RAM? Are we talking DDR2 type
now,
sort of stuff?
Or? You've got me without notice there. I have no idea.
No, I'd just be curious to know, because obviously in the PC world, the DDR3 RAM, which is even faster yet again, is starting to make headway into motherboards and things like that. And RAM, as we know, is relatively cheap, thanks to Vista. There's one thing we've got to thank Vista for. It's because all these manufacturers went out,
we have to buy lots of RAM.
We have to get RAM because we've got to make it to work for Vista, and no one bought Vista, so we've got this glut of RAM, haven't we?
So apart from being faster in processor speed, it's got support for 7.2 megabit HSDPA. So
there's a sore point in this country.
Except that you can't get it in Telstra because Telstra aren't supporting it, but that's okay.
Is it?
Well, probably not.
Is it? Well, I alluded to in the opening of the show here, you're going to invest all this money, this good hard-earned money, in a device which is, fully optioned up for the internet world, and you can't use it. Mm. Why?
Who knows? But anyway, Telstra have chosen. They're not really that interested in it. But yet Vodafone and who is Optus?
Optus are both, said yes.
Both keen to it. Yet their networks, I think, only cracks 3.6. I could be wrong. I could stand corrected, but I don't think there is anywhere near to the speed of what Telstra is.
So some other things. It's got the digital compass that everyone's probably known about for a while. It's been leaked for forever. A 3-megapixel camera with autofocus and macro mode that'll make some people happy.
MMS?
Still not the 5-megapixel. Does have MMS.
Oh, so people can actually now send pictures off your iPhone.
Works on any network, apparently. It now does video recording out of the box. I had to hack mine to do that, but it'll do that out of the box and automatically upload to YouTube and various other places. They've done a really nifty thing.
You need data plans now, don't you?
They've done a really nifty thing with Mobile Me, which is their computing cloud, is you can now access the location of your own phone if it gets lost. You can turn.
Oh, I heard about this. This is pretty cool, yeah.
You can turn it to non-vibrate mode remotely so that if you really want to make a noise on your phone because someone's stolen it, you can turn it off silent mode.
And how is it you get it to go into that mode?
If through Mobile Me. So you log into Mobile
Me. Oh, okay, from your PC, from your Mac or whatever.
You trigger it to
Let's just paint the scenario here. Someone nicks or you lose your mobile phone and you're trying to find it. You've left it on the train.
Falls behind the couch.
Yep. Yeah, so, well, there's a thought too.
Now, that could be interesting.
It's like the old key rings that used to have to whistle the
keys. Oh, I remember those. Yeah. Great concept.
Even better than that. Yeah. So you can turn on its GPS so you can work out where it is. Now, if it's in the couch, then you're going to have a problem because, of course...
But at least you know it's at home and not in the car or left it at work or something like that.
It's somewhere in the house.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So
you can tell it to go into loud mode, so it'll actually make noises, even if you've left it in vibrate mode.
There's the whistle that you talk of, Dr. Ron.
Yes, yes.
And you can make it ring. So there you go. There's the whistle. But also, you can flash a message up on the screen like, bring it back, you horrible person.
Oh, really?
Mm.
Yes.
And you can wipe it remotely. So if you know it's gone, but you want to say or prevent your data from being lost to somebody else, you can actually remotely wipe it now.
That's good. Don't let that command get hold into your friend's hands.
Now, you could have fun if you had somebody else's account, couldn't you?
Absolutely. Sorry, Mark's over there. I'll let me push your fader up over there. Everyone, ladies and gentlemen, here is Mark Mayer.
Sorry, a question without notice to the board. Can you make phone calls with it?
With the phone?
Yeah.
Yes, you can.
Oh, wow. Well, that's good. I was curious.
You can do that too.
Yeah.
So the old model's going to get cheaper and still around. The new models, prices are yet to be known. They've got lots of memory in them and so forth.
They're cheaper, aren't they?
So they... I haven't heard that.
Yeah?
I haven't heard
Unofficially,
that.
They're cheaper. But we'll wait to see.
We'll wait and see.
When is it? The 26th of this month?
26th of June.
June.
I saw in the press release that the existing iPhones are going to drop to $99 just to move all the old stock.
Well,
how good's that?
They weren't that much more anyway.
Mm.
So, yeah, that's
yeah,
not
but
a
you'd
huge
be dark
thing.
Over here if you'd signed up to one of those big plans with one of the providers and you're stuck with it for
and
2 years.
And that $99 is on a plan as well in the States. So.
Mm. Right, right. Oh, so it's a $99 plan, is it?
No, it'll be $99 for the phone plus a plan.
Okay. All right.
And can you, do you still need to activate them the old-fashioned way?
Yes,
like through
you do.
A phone company?
Yeah. Yes, you do.
That's a bummer, really, isn't
Which
it?
Which means, generally speaking, they're locked to the provider you buy them from at the moment.
Mm. Oh, well. The other, I guess, as an adjacent story, DVD John got up to no good at the Worldwide Developers Conference with a big sign opposite.
Oh, what did he do?
Oh, he put a billboard up directly opposite the venue where everyone was going in for the Worldwide Developers Conference with the cure for iPhone envy, your iTunes library on any device in seconds with the appropriate Apple logo and all that sort of stuff. And everyone thought it was legit, but the Cupertino boys didn't see the sense
of
humor. So anyway, apparently Apple's been left red-faced after the billboard promoting iTunes alternative was posted outside the flagship store. The billboard was promoted by Double Twist, a software company run by the famous hacker John Lek Johansson, who's the man who brought to you I can't think of the exact acronym for it, but it's like the encryption code for DVDs. And he's on Blu-rays now too, just so everyone knows. So for these people who like getting out there and doing things, it was a bit of a joke which went, I don't know, noticed.
Yeah.
So there you go. So we've got the 3G coming very shortly, the 3GS.
3GS. 3G speed.
Yeah, which hopefully the other networks will ramp up the speed a little bit and see how we travel.
Now, this new operating system for the 3GS, the operating system is going to be available for owners of the current version of the
iPhone.
All versions, is it? Okay.
Some models won't do certain things. So you can install iPhone 3, if you like,
yep.
into your first generation. And I know Adam's got one of those,
yep.
about his person. But it won't do MMS. So mine, which is the 3G.
That's because it physically, electronically can't.
I don't know that that's true.
Isn't it?
No.
No?
I'm not quite sure what the reason is, but it won't do MMS. Mine won't do certain other features. Obviously, that hasn't got a digital compass, so I won't do that. And obviously, the brand new phone will do everything out of the box.
I do. We were playing around with an iPhone in the office during the course of the week, playing with Google Maps. And it seems strange that I think the phone thought it was in the northern hemisphere because what was up was down and what was down was up was really quite funny.
Oh, really? But
yeah, because as you rotate the phone around, it actually turns the map around inside. Yeah, but it seemed to be the opposite side of the planet for it. So anyway, maybe it was just the phone that we were looking at. I don't know. In other news, is that it for the Apple guys? Is that it?
Oh, that's probably enough, isn't it?
Yeah, well, we can always come back for more. Mm. Just because we'd like a bit of balance here, Microsoft to sell Windows, this is the new Windows 7 operating system in the EU without a browser. And people, like, it's one of those sort of conundrums where the EU have been going, antitrust, antitrust, antitrust. You know, you can't monopolize the market with a browser in it. So Microsoft's turned around and said, all right, we won't have the browser. And everyone in Europe's now gone, uh-oh, we haven't got a browser. We'll have to load one up.
Have to download and install Firefox
yeah.
as soon as we load
or
up
Chrome.
Windows. Or Chrome.
Yeah. Or IE. I guess you can download it and install. It'll be an option there. They won't take it off the install disk, surely. It'll be, do you want Internet Explorer? Yes, no.
They just have to go back as far as the competition regulators will let them go before anyone kicks up a fuss, I suppose. Because they've always had a contention there that it's bundled too tightly with the operating system and it should be free of choice for everybody to load the browser, whatever browser it is that they want to run.
Now people will complain that it's too
now
hard.
Now people will complain it's too hard. Well, we're going to install a browser now. This is crazy. We're spending all this money on a new operating system and how come we have to download it?
Absolutely.
And I wonder what features won't be supported if you don't have IE installed.
Well, that's the catch 22 really, isn't it? What won't work? Because the whole basis of the operating system is based around TCP/IP and Windows, you know, Internet Explorer, you know, code really, isn't it?
Yeah, it's...
after all, the desktop's a website, really, isn't it?
Well, the Explorer engine is a fundamental part of the operating system. Mm. It runs the, like Windows Explorer, the File Explorer, the browsing.
Yeah, but that Explorer.exe is still separate from iExplorer.exe.
It is, yeah,
so,
right.
Yeah, they are, you know, it's not quite that tight, but yeah, there'll be some things that'll... be a little bit tricky.
Anyway, that's the price you pay for compliance in the EU these days. So, yeah, all's fair in love and war, I guess.
Hmm.
All right, you're listening to Tech Talk Radio. Dr. Ron, Graham Callaghan, JD, and myself, Andrew McComb. We've got Mark Mayer in, who you've heard before. We're going to be talking to him after the break. In fact, we're going to hear from Adam Turner after the break about mobile voice over IP.
Ah.
Now, this is... not what it's cracked out to be.
I don't have mobile voice over IP. I've got Skype Mobile Lite.
And Adam will tell you all about. You might have had a pre-listen to it or anything like that.
I have not, no.
No? We'll come back and talk about it.
I fielded a lot of questions from Adam during the week. I think you did too. And
yes.
Oh, he was looking for screen grabs of Skype on the HTC.
Absolutely. I think it's come up in a newspaper somewhere. Yes. So
yes, be very aware of what you're getting.
All right. We'll take a break. We'll be back with more in a moment.
You're listening to Australia's most informative technology show.
Tech Talk Radio.
Police called to control crowds at a technology fair in Singapore.
The sale of Apple TVs has gone up a third in the past year.
How frustrating.
Very.
Twitter came to life like you wouldn't believe.
What next, I say?
Around about $10 billion from the NBN.
Well, that's a bit unusual, isn't it? I'm not sure what to make of that.
Those people who found themselves hacked turned into porn stars very quickly.
Entertaining.
Oh, look, Dr. Ron, I haven't seen you like that before.
Informative.
Like my old phone, is at like 32 by 32 pixels?
Independent.
Well, that's impressive.
I smoke, that's right.
You're listening to Tech Talk Radio.
Don't breathe this.
You're listening to Tech Talk Radio.
Ah, that you are. Welcome back to Tech Talk Radio. Have you got Skype on your mobile? Dr. Ron, I know you have.
I do. I do, just very recently.
Yes. And it's a funny version of Skype Lite or something we were discussing. Now, Dr. Graham, have you got one? You've got Fring.
I've got Fring, but I haven't quite figured out how to make use of it terribly well yet.
I've actually loaded up Fring, and it uses Skype to make calls out. Mm. It's awfully confusing, but there is method to the madness here.
Yes.
JD, are you a Skype-y person?
I've got Skype, but it doesn't work on my version of the iPhone.
Oh, good. That'll do it every time. Well, you're upgrading, aren't you? You might get a good version of Skype that'll actually work
for
you.
You're getting a 3GS, won't you, fairly soon?
Oh, I don't know about the phone itself. I'll get the new operating system.
Get work to buy you one. Splash out and give all any employees one of those.
Yeah, lots of money.
That's what employers are for, isn't it? All that sort of stuff. Anyway, during the course of the week, as you mentioned during the, or actually as we went to the last break there, Dr. Ron, we all got pestered by Adam Turner in relation to doing some Skype tests for him. And what it did reveal was some very interesting findings, and that is, to summarise it, that Skype in itself is somewhat a little bit disappointing on mobile devices these days. But far be it from me to tell you any more about it. We'll talk about it after this. Here's Adam Turner's View from the Couch and a bit about Skype on a handset.
The idea of mobile VoIP, making phone calls over the internet from your mobile phone, would seem like a communications utopia. Unfortunately, it's not as great as you'd think. The technology isn't the key problem. The key problem is that phone makers and VoIP providers often deliberately cripple their products in order to appease the telco giants. The result is that you can still use VoIP on your phone, but not always in the way you want to use it, and it's unlikely to save you much money. For an example of how mobile VoIP is often crippled, you need look no further than Skype, certainly the world's most popular internet telephony service. Right now, there are only 3 Skype clients available for download from the Skype website for mobile phones: iPhone, Windows Mobile, and Mobile. The mobile version is Skype Lite, software designed to work on many phones from LG, Motorola, Nokia, Samsung, and Sony Ericsson, as well as Android-powered phones such as Dr. Ron's HTC Dream and the new HTC Magic. There's also a customized Skype client pre-installed on some phones from the 3 network, letting you make hours worth of free Skype calls from your mobile each month using X-Series Skype Minutes, and this is something that Andrew uses a lot. Of all these offerings, the Windows Mobile version of Skype is the only one that will let you make cheap or free Skype calls from anywhere to anyone, as it works over Wi-Fi or mobile broadband and lets you make both Skype to Skype and Skype in or Skype out calls. Skype out is the service that lets you make a Skype call to a real phone. It costs you a few cents a minute, but it's a lot cheaper than STD or mobile rates. Now, the iPhone version of the Skype client doesn't allow you to make calls over mobile broadband, so it only works when you're in a Wi-Fi network. The 3X series version of Skype doesn't allow Skype out, so you can't ring other phone lines, you can only ring Skype users. And the disappointing Skype Lite client charges you mobile rates even if you're calling other Skype users. Now, Nokia intends to release a full Skype client for the N97 later this year, and all indications are that it will be as fully featured as the Windows Mobile version. Some telcos are already demanding that Nokia remove the app. Now, the Skype Lite client is certainly the biggest disappointment, as Dr. Ron discovered on his HTC Dream. Rather than using Wi-Fi or mobile broadband, Skype Lite runs over the mobile phone network and thus charges you mobile rates even to ring other Skype users. To add insult to injury, if you're using Skype Lite on your mobile phone, it will cost you money to receive calls from other Skype users. If you answer an incoming Skype Lite call, you start chewing through your Skype out credit as if you'd made a call. The woeful Skype Lite actually makes Skype on the iPhone look good. Although Skype on the iPhone, as I said, is restricted to making calls over Wi-Fi and is hampered by the fact that Apple won't let apps run in the background. I'm keen to see whether Skype releases an update when we get the iPhone 3.0 software, because that gives apps a little bit more freedom to do things in the background. Of course, there are other ways to make VoIP calls on your mobile, such as the Skype-compatible Fring service, but I've found Fring's call quality to be pretty woeful on both mobile broadband and Wi-Fi. I've had better results using VoIP providers such as Pennytel and MyNetPhone, who offer their own software. But the sound quality is still hit and miss due to the larger number of factors at play when it comes to mobile VoIP. It's sad that the phones with the best Skype client, Windows Mobile, are also the phones with the worst user interface. I'd say one of the reasons why Skype on Windows Mobile isn't seen as too much of a threat is that the majority of Windows Mobile devices are work phones, so users don't care about VoIP because they're not paying for their calls anyway. Making VoIP calls from your phone is a great dream, but in reality, the results are pretty disappointing.
Entertaining, informative, and independent. You're listening to Tech Talk Radio.
So there's the Skype rundown. Disappointed?
Yeah, a little bit. It does make sense what Adam has just said. It didn't make sense to me when I first started playing with it. I called another Skype user, and the software actually rings a gateway number in Sydney, and it sets up the call through that gateway. So you're actually you're making a phone call, but you're using voice over IP. You're using Skype to connect from that gateway to the other Skype user.
It's absolutely ridiculous.
I know. I'm not arguing with you. It is ridiculous, but this is
you
what
say you're a little bit disappointed. I would be absolutely furious. It's not Skype. It's just making a phone call.
That's all it is. It's making a phone call. And we've got these X series.
You're having a lend of yours, they say in the classics.
Yeah.
We've got the, well,
it's a complete and utter ripoff.
Well, you're using the Skype network in that you are ultimately connecting to a Skype user who is using voice over IP, but you're using a gateway when you've got it installed on your mobile phone.
The whole point of Skype is that it runs as data.
I agree.
It's voice over IP, and it's not. You're just making a phone call.
I agree.
You may as well just talk to your friend using their Skype in.
Now, with Fring, Graham, which is the other product, does that use the actual data network on the phone system?
Yeah, Fring's one of these third-party things that has a client for everything. It'll talk to Skype and MSN Messenger and Google Chat and goodness knows what else. A dozen other clients, all built into one. But yeah, I presume since it's not an official Skype product that it's not quite using the latest Skype technology. So yeah, your call quality isn't what it should be.
Is it hacking into the Skype network or is it its own network?
Hacking probably would be too strong a word.
Well, they're emulating a Skype client.
It's connecting to the Skype network. It's emulating an older Skype client. Yes,
right.
Is what I assume.
Now I did a test during the week with Adam with Fring and Skype out.
Yep.
And we actually were using mobile broadband, yes, not Skype, and then Skype out rang his office number. And let me tell you, the audio quality wasn't flash, but it wasn't unusable. You wouldn't want to be in a mobile environment trying to hear it. But the downside was you could hear yourself coming back, which was not too flash. And there was quite a delay. It was a bit like the good old days where you're talking to the man in the moon and over.
Yeah.
It was a bit like a simplex contact, if you know what I mean. One person talks and the next person talks.
It'd be interesting to work out whether that's because of some problem with the Fring client or with Skype. But just connecting up your mobile phone's data connection to your PC and doing a couple of pings to see what the lag time on your mobile broadband connection is. It might be that simply that mobile broadband is just too slow.
I'd like to try Fring. It's not available in the Australian Android market yet, so I can't download it and install it on my HTC Dream. But Graham's got Fring installed on his Nokia mobile phone.
Yep.
And
I've just installed it on my iPhone while we were chatting.
So there you go. Feeling left out again, Dr. Ron?
Yeah, once again, HTC Dream.
Everyone here has got Fring installed.
The Google phone is left behind. That's when you think you're at the forefront of technology, you're not.
Anyway, now I use the Skype to talk to Lydia in the United States quite regularly because she has her laptop on all the time. And when you're driving down the street, you can tell. You can see when people are online because it goes your green Skype tick. And that works well because instead of paying telephone call rates to another country, you're just paying a free call, basically, to the gateway and then connecting to them on Skype. So that works for me. One of the instances where it does work for a international call in particular. Or I guess that would work too on an Australian or a national call if you're talking to someone on a PC or even using Skype out. But then again, Skype out, it doesn't work unless you use Fring.
But the calls to that gateway number when you make an outbound call, do they eat into your Skype minutes? Or
yes,
is that
part
of your normal
it.
Cap?
That's how they measure it.
That's where the Skype minutes come in.
Yeah, yeah. All right. So when if you're on a provider that offers you a Skype gateway and you try and connect to someone on Skype, watch the handset closely and see if you see that number come up. Sometimes it comes up as a 02 number or sometimes it comes up as another mobile number and you'll know that you're actually doing a voice call to a Skype gateway and then connecting to whoever you're talking to via the internet from that Skype gateway.
There was a penny dropping moment for me as well when you have to log in to the client which you have to do whether you're on a computer or whether you're on a mobile phone or whatever. And but with the mobile phone, with Skype Lite Beta, you have to put your mobile phone number in. And I originally thought, why am I putting my mobile phone number in? There's nothing here that needs to know what my mobile phone number is. Why can't you pull that out of the phone anyway? But that's another story. But the reason obviously is so that if you are going to make an outbound call, it can marry up your incoming call at their gateway with whatever it is you've told it to dial over the data
and
network.
And also presumably so that it can feed calls coming back in from Skype to your Skype client. It would have to ring your phone.
That's right.
So yeah, again, it's just pretending to be Skype. It's actually making phone calls.
Mm.
Warlock on our chats, speaking highly of your Android there, Dr. Ron.
He doesn't like it much, does he?
Android doesn't. Yes. Yeah, anyway.
Warlock's always fairly acidic with his comments. I better go and have a look at that. yes, Java garbage, says Warlock. Yes. Well, we'll see what Skype has in store for us, and especially we'll keep an eye on the new 3GS and version 3 of the Apple's operating system there. See if we get a new client.
All right, you're listening to Tech Talk Radio. We're going to be talking to Mark Mayer in just a second.
Listening to Tech Talk Radio.
All right. When it comes to flying, when it comes to aviation, when it comes to aeroplanes, who do we think of here in Tech Talk Radio? Welcome back to Mark Mayer from, I don't know, what have you been up to, Mark? You must have been,
I've been around. Thank you for having me. It's a pleasure to be back.
Oh, look, pleasure. There's been lots happening. That's why we had to ring you.
There has been, yes.
Mark, come in and talk to us.
Unfortunately, the aviation sits in a quiet little corner, just going about its business, flying thousands of aeroplanes and millions of people around the world until a few things pop up and then it's in the front of everyone's forethoughts.
Yes.
But, there have been a few interesting things. But before I say anything, I just wanted to say for the record, all opinions and statements made by me about Airbus or any other aircraft made that sound similar to that are my opinions only.
Are we going to be talking about Airbus tonight?
Could be talking a little bit about Airbus A330s. There has been a few things, and unfortunately, very tragic things as well. The Air France is very tragic.
Well, and I guess that's really you're looking at a breed of aircraft there, which is. Like everything, when something big happens, everyone's eyes turn and look at this particular model and breed of aircraft. And we're seeing, was it Jetstar the other day? Had a similar
Jetstar
issue
as well,
and things
with
like
their
that.
Window heat, yes. It goes, well, actually, if you want to look at it, it's maybe a, what do you call it, a coincidence of occurrences. One of the first big things that happened with the A330 was back in October last year. You probably all remember the in-flight upset for the Qantas A330 flying back from.
Was it Singapore?
It was. It was quite a horrific situation. From the interim factual report from the Air Safety Transport Bureau, they've got a bit of a report on it, which is actually good background information. I'll just give you a bit of an idea. The aircraft was flying from Singapore to Perth, and about 37,000 feet, it experienced a significant command pitch down while responding to various system failures. Now, this is very interesting. The investigation identified two significant safety factors related to the pitch-down movements. Firstly, after the autopilot disconnected, one of the air data inertial reference units, ADIRUs, started providing erroneous data to the other parameters in the systems. Now, an air data reference unit is... it's a key component of the air data system, which supplies raw data to other computers, and the raw data being airspeed, angle of attack, altitude, inertia of the aircraft, where it is in the world, position and altitude. And it takes those raw data feeds into a computer and then uses that information to give us to our electronic flight instruments. So we know our artificial horizon, where we are in the flight plan, how fast we're going, what Mach number we're at, what pitch and what the outside air temperature is and the outside air pressure is and all those sorts of things. So the ADIRU is a really, really important instrument. So if that malfunctions, it's now sending garbage in, garbage out. So it's
Do they have a redundant system?
Well, they do. They have three of them on the A330. But the maintenance for the post-flight report on this actual incident, they found that indicated there was a problem with the ADIRU-1. The other two were okay, but this one had been sending bad information. And secondly, some of the spikes from the angle attacks were not filtered by the aircraft's flight control computers. Not to get too technical, but there's a computer that checks the information before it sends the information on. So a system that...
A sort of a sanity check. That number can't change that much that quickly.
Exactly. Yeah. That's a sanity check. So raw data comes in. This system takes with raw information. That information gets to a sanity check, says, does that make sense? It says, yes, that makes sense. Then it sends that information to our flight instruments, basically. Unfortunately, in this set of circumstances, that didn't happen quite the right way. The flight control computers generated an undesired pitch down from the elevator control, because whatever the information came in this situation said, oh, we need to pitch down. And it said, yep, that makes sense. Okay, pitch down. And so they're sitting there having their cup of tea and going, bang, suddenly an 8 degrees nose pitch down with almost a negative 1 degree in the aircraft. So that happened, and then the aircraft...
What sort of legitimate event would occur, Mark, that would make an aircraft do that? Well, why would an aircraft need to make that sort of a pitch?
Well, see, that's the problem. That's the exact problem, Ron. No one really knows. because there is no... A straight and level flight, which is what 99.9% of all your flying is, is that the only time an aircraft would either make a quick commanded down would be maybe an incursion of aircraft hitting something.
Yeah.
Where it, like ground proximity or aircraft proximity, where it'd say, pitch up, too close. And in the 737 I used to fly, didn't have exactly the same automated as the Airbus, but it did have a warning if it's called a close encounter or a near miss, it would say, aircraft, pull up, or aircraft, push down, and it would tell us to, oh, heck, we need to pitch down, we need to pitch up. But this is sort of telling it to do it by itself.
So it's not like something you'd encounter in normal flying, like an air pocket or an updraft or something where it's trying to compensate for it.
If you're at 37,000 feet over the middle of over just Western Australia,
you don't get sudden updraft.
You're not going to get anything there that's going to give you that information.
So did this occur during an autopilot, or was this during controlled flight?
It was controlled flight, but the autopilots were on. There's two or usually three autopilots. There's redundancies there again. But the autopilot's disconnected, and it suddenly went into the pitch. And they controlled the aircraft, brought it back, and then it did it again a couple of minutes later. So then they diverted to Learmonth and landed there. The upshot for that, and this is why this is a long answer, because it's important to the Air France one, all the ADRs were ADIRUs were taken for testing, and they're still being tested right now. Two occurrences have occurred where ADIRUs have failed again. One was the exact same ADIRU, failed again, and this time, the first time it actually occurred was in 2006 with this exact same aircraft, the exact same IRU. However, it didn't give the pitch down. It just came up with a fail and a fail warning system. They did the procedures to shut it down, and then when it was tested on the ground, they could find no fault. And then again, a different one, the second event occurred with the ADIRU on December 27th, 2008. Qantas A330 again had a same failure system come up, but they then did a different procedure of shutting down and checking, which has been made by an air. It's called an aircraft order, where we knew a new checklist had been brought out from training from the other one. So nothing really bad happened from that. But...
The Airbus said that they don't consider the fault to be serious enough to ground the world's fleet.
This is speculative now.
This is what I pre-say as my opinion.
That's what Airbus have said. So clearly, they think that if there is a fault, that it's manageable to the point whereby they can release some sort of safety notice to all the airlines and say, this is what we're investigating at the moment. This is how you manage the situation if it occurs.
Well, look, it's a balance, and they're probably right, but there's a balance because they've got to cover their own. But because if they say there is a major malfunction, then there's 600 of these flying around the world at any one time.
Yep.
And that means there's millions of dollars worth of lawsuits, compensation, et cetera, et cetera.
Absolutely.
Yep. And sometimes these things are achievable to be fixed and corrected. But when you're talking about such an insidious thing, it's a little bit worrying. It's a little bit worrying. And I'm a little bit worried about it because they still haven't actually found it. What they have done, like you said, Ron, they've said, okay, this is a new procedure. When you get this warning and get this, do this. But... for the guys over in Western Australia, they didn't...
There was no warning.
Bang, yeah. well, you asked me about this pre-show. The crew that actually flew that, this is true. The captain retired and didn't want to fly anymore, and the first officer and second officer refused to fly Airbuses anymore, and they want to be changed over to Boeings. Mm. It gave them a big fright. It was very frightening, and it's, well, it's 11 people were seriously injured, and most of that was caused because people either had their seatbelts not on or they were standing. And they also found that...
Which is normal and just...
Which is normal, yes, yeah. Right. But they found... Well, they always tell you to have your seatbelt, you know, loosely done up and undone.
Loosely fastened.
Loosely fastened, yeah. They also found, and this is something I found interesting, that the investigation identified there's a potential design problem which can lead to the inverted release of a seatbelt if it's loosely fastened.
Oh,
and I don't know
me.
Anything more about that except what that report said. My guess would be, you know, when it is loose, it sits there. When you get a negative G, you go up like this. If your hand or your handbag or whatever's in your lap accidentally hit that clip, you'd undo your seatbelt. Mm. But if it was down lower, it'd probably be less likely to get hooked by something. That's my guess. But the problem with this whole flight, this whole investigation is that the flight standing order has been put in place to cope with it as best we can, but they're not expecting a final report for this till the end of 2009. Mm. So that's in the background while, when you ask me this question... Air France. Now, Air France has got a big major problem with this. We don't know where the black boxes are, the so-called black boxes.
It's on the bottom of the ocean somewhere.
Yeah, the bottom of the ocean. I've got a map of the world here, which I probably don't need to see, but where they're lost is in the middle of the ocean. Mm. And to know what happens, we have three. There's three data. There's a flight data recorder, which records all the data. There's a cockpit voice recorder, which records everything that we've been saying in the cockpit. And then there's another recorder that records any ambient sound in the cockpit. So that means if there's a passenger in the cockpit or a flight attendant walking in and stuff like that, they're all recorded on these hard.
It's interesting. I never knew that they recorded the
ambient sound. I didn't know that
sound
either.
In aircraft.
That's amazing.
In the cockpit area.
Yeah.
And those are crucial, and they have a 30-day lifespan that they send out a signal. So they're waterproof, watertight. If they're at the bottom of the ocean, they'll be sending a signal out, but they've got to find them.
Yeah. As we know, radio waves and water don't mix too well.
And it's really a needle in a haystack, mm-hmm. and they've got special sonar aircraft and watercraft looking for them, but they only last for about 30 days, the batteries. And so it's the 15th day, and it went down the 1st. So they've only got another 15 days to find them. If they don't find them, then it will be conjecture because if they don't find those, they need big parts of the aircraft to find. If they find large parts of the aircraft, they can put together
the
little pieces.
The aircraft will be in the same place in the bottom of the ocean, won't they?
Probably. Exactly right, Grant. So it's a catch-22.
If they find them after, the next 15 days, Mark, the data is still going to be
there. Oh, the data will still be there. But
yeah, it'll
be impossible to find.
Yep.
You know how big the
ocean
is. Well,
they're painted bright red, aren't they?
Yes, it's funny. Yeah, the black boxes are. Yeah, they're
tad dark
bright,
down there, though.
Yeah, they're iridescent, like fluoro. Ready, orange,
but you
green
have to get
colour.
Close enough to see them.
Yeah. Well, they're not very big. They're not very big. But
all right, you're listening to Tech Talk Radio. We're chatting with Mark Mayer, who is a retired commercial airline pilot. We're talking about all sorts of things aviation tonight. Obviously, our point of interest is the Air France issue, which happened about 2 weeks ago over the Atlantic Ocean. Now, Mark, what do you think happened? Obviously, this is your opinion. What do you think happened in those last moments leading up to
this is
potentially where
question.
We're at? Where we're at now?
My answer will be based on conjecture, reading, and et cetera, what I've put together for myself. So it's not based on fact. And one of the most important things, all this information we have is only tiny little pieces of the jigsaw. And, you know, no one's really going to know all the answers to the end. But let's look at the first things we know generally. Firstly, there's been reports that there was bad weather in the area. Yes, there was bad weather in the area. But most modern aircraft have really, well, these ones do have very good onboard radar. Plus, we have good weather reports beforehand. Plus,
how
we get
old
updates.
Is this aircraft, just out of curiosity?
Oh,
not the age of, I think this one was 2 years old or something.
Yeah.
How long has this model of aircraft been around?
It started in 1994, I think. Mm-hmm. 93 or 94, so it's not very old. Mm. There's about 600 of them, and they're derivative of A320 to A330, A340 then. So weather is in the area. Apparently a couple of aircraft flew the same flight path, Lufthansa and other ones later, and they didn't have much problem going around the weather. We don't fly into major thunderstorms. Pilots do not fly into a huge storm, but if you get stuck, you may have to go close skidding around it, because the further you go off track, the more fuel you're burning. The more fuel you're burning are going to cross cross-ocean flight like this, you've got to be very careful how you use it. But they wouldn't have flown directly into a storm. But let's say they did get into bad weather. Then some people have conjectured, oh, they got struck by lightning. Well, that's true. They could have been struck by lightning. Now, lightning strikes happen all the time, and aircraft are designed to be hit by lightning. The best data I could find was the last time an aircraft had a crash because of lightning strike was in 1967, where it actually made the fuel tank explode. But aircraft are designed, they're aluminium, the surface is very, very strongly sealed, so there's no gaps and joins, so that the current will hit and going to go out again. There's also
That's what those little antennae-looking things exactly. are like on the aircraft wings, isn't
dissipate,
it? That's where,
yes. Yeah. Well, sometimes, quite often, an aircraft will start the lightning will actually come out from the airplane because there's so much charge
conductor.
Around.
Mm,
yeah, the conductor, you understand. But if they do get struck, it should shield it. From the surface. Secondly, all the electrical components have very heavy shielding, and the fuel tank ports where you get fuel in are protected. They're supposed to be able to take a lightning bolt straight onto the fuel tank cap, for another better word. However, nothing's perfect. Maybe they did get a strike. Maybe in this circumstances with the ADIRU, maybe it gave it some spurious information. So weather could have been a factor. But I don't think a lightning bolt knocked it down, but it could have caused some
Weren't there
problem.
Reports that that there was some radio transmissions from the plane, some automatic
They were automatic.
That's, yeah, that's the key thing that bothers me too, Greg.
Because that suggests that it wasn't something instantaneous like a lightning strike or a bomb.
Yeah.
It was something that took a while to develop.
Well, yes and no. While to develop, what I would say was, if it was a lightning strike, that would take a long while, actually, because we'd be hit at 37,000 feet. There'd be failures. Things were going off. You'd be surges of different instruments okay. going off. That would take a while. To me, there was, I think, 24 automated fault warnings were sent out automatically by the ACAR system. That's a radio system that sends out information to the engineers and ports. They went out. No radio calls went out. That's what bothers me.
No voice calls.
No mayday, no pan. When Qantas had the in-flight disturbance in October last year, they put out a pan at first because it was quite serious. And then when they got the report of serious injuries, they upgraded to a mayday.
A pan.
Then they landed Learmonth.
Pan is a code that you use on the radio to indicate a very urgent situation that's
not
life-threatening yet.
Exactly.
Step below mayday.
100%. Yeah, 100% is correct. Yeah. And mayday means imminent life is either lost or going to be lost if we don't comply with what we need to do. Nothing that came from Air France. Now, these pilots were, Air France is a good airline, good airplane. If they didn't get a chance to say a single word as a mayday, now they were outside controlled airspace, which means where they're basically in the middle of the ocean, halfway between both.
It's not just that they didn't have anyone to talk to there.
Everyone can hear them still. They're still within radio frequency. They're just not in controlled airspace because the radar control only goes a certain far because the radar can only pick the aircraft up
but
at
even,
certain distances.
Even at that part of the trip, I would have thought everything would have been automatic. People would be, as you say, having their cup of tea by then.
Everyone had been sitting around having dinner, been fine. I mean, for them not to get a radio call out is the really worrying thing for me, because if they didn't, that means something catastrophic and very quick. And that kind of means that, to me as a pilot, that maybe a huge pitch up or a huge pitch down or a huge roll where you become virtually incapacitated because the G-forces be able to do much other than wrestle with the aeroplane. And when those G-forces happen, wings break off, tailplanes break off, and then you're a falling piece of metal. Mm. And then you don't have time to even say anything. You just got a minute and a half till you hit the ground and dead. So that's why it's very worrying. And the problem I was saying way back in the beginning.
But even still, wouldn't you have been able to get a call out? Even if something like that, would it really just be that instantaneous that was it, you're incapacitated?
They can happen. Well, the reason, I know it seems unbelievable. A number of years ago, and I don't, this is off the top of my head, Air Lauda 767 had a catastrophic in-flight disaster where one engine went full thrust forward, the other went full thrust reverse in flight, snapped
that'd
it off.
That'd be a Huey, wouldn't it?
Yeah, well, exactly, like a
big Huey.
Basically, it broke the airplane in half in flight, and it just bang, straight down. That's not, these are my opinions again, but that's the kind of thing I'm getting at. Andrew's right. You think even if you're plummeting towards the earth, you'd say something. Yeah, you think you would. So that gets me back to thinking, and it's only my opinion again, that something catastrophic could have happened where broke the airplane instantly. So a wing, it's falling in pieces from the middle of the sky. And the problem we have is we're not going to know if we don't get the FR recorder.
Yeah. Mark, airspeed sensors, I'm probably going to pronounce this incorrectly, is it
pitot tubes.
Yeah, there was some comment about whether they played a role in the Air France incident.
It's a good question.
Also, Aerobus apparently have accelerated a replacement program of its pitot sensors in the Airbus A330 and Airbus A340.
Now, these are the things that Qantas came out and said that, oh, we get ours from a different supplier. So this obviously seems to be some sort of...
Pinot tube is a very interesting thing. It's a little thing that sticks out. Like it looks like a cigar with a little hole in the end, and it measures air pressure and temperature.
The other things that point forward on the front of the aircraft, aren't they?
Yeah. In light aircraft, you'll see them under the wing just sticking out, and they've got to be clear. They've got to be make sure they get no ice on them, because if they get iced and you go up, you give all sorts
of erroneous readings.
And there's been some terrible accidents many years ago, 727. I'm talking 20, 30 years ago. Iced over. They didn't turn the pitot heat on. And it iced up. And as they were climbing, they thought they were going too fast. And they were going faster and faster. And they kept pulling back. And they eventually stalled the aircraft and hit the ground. But anyhow, that's just a bit of background. The speed sensors aboard the aircraft may have malfunctioned. This is a problem that they've known about. And the sensors aboard the flight hadn't been replaced, but that was only a recommendation for Airbus. And it's important to stress that this information only represents one part of it. And this was a recommendation, not a safety critical requirement. And that's from
the difference. So it's one of hundreds of things they'd be looking at to see if it's contributed or not.
And there are many other ways to determine speed, and it would be dangerous really to draw a conclusion that that was the actual problem. But again, it may have been a contributor. Mm-hmm. So it's a very good question. And again, as I keep saying, and it's such a terrible thing, if we don't get a flight data recorder,
it's just going to be conjecture.
Yep. If we don't have any big pieces, it'll be one of those worst things of that no one will actually never know except for conjecture.
It's interesting, isn't it? Because I think the only pictures we've seen is a tail fin floating around in the water with some people playing on it.
Yeah.
I think when I spoke to you originally on the phone saying, come and talk to us on the radio, Mark, that it was interesting, the debris trail over the water. I think you were saying that at 35,000 feet, if a plane, like it was over a 5 kilometre area. What does that tell you?
Well, that means it had a high impact, I guess. Either if it broke up in the sky, it came down. But it means that to me it hit at a really high impact, which means totally out of control, which means that either passenger flight crew either totally incapacitated, they're unconscious or dead or had no control. So,
but the other thing that they've said is that based on the pieces of the aircraft that they've found so far, it wasn't caused by an explosion.
Yeah, they've kind of ruled that out, because there's a lot of forensics. They work on accelerators and things that, like, if there was a bomb on board, they've kind of ruled that out, and no one's claimed, like, the logical gates that you go through for things. No one's claimed any responsibility. Mm. There wasn't any suspicious people on the passenger manifest. Plus, there's no telltale burns of certain types.
No evidence of an explosion looking at the wreckage we've got.
So far. So it's a hard one, isn't it? It's really, really bad.
All right, you're listening to Tech Talk Radio. We're talking to Mark Mayer, who is a retired commercial airline pilot. We're talking a little bit about Air France. We're going to take a break, and when we come back, we'll talk about other aviation things.
You're listening to Tech Talk Radio. Twitter? We do. Why not follow us? For the Tech Talk Radio Twitter feed, follow TTR2008 or visit techtalkradio.com.au to see what all the presenters are currently tweeting.
We've now got the technology. It's time to get silly with it.
Are people still using Internet Explorer?
That would be a shame.
Do you reckon it'll take up? I reckon the youth of today will love it.
Like a Dr. Evil's boardroom.
Yeah, it does change the way the browser behaves.
Oh, I'm excited. Don't worry about Kaspersky. Get into your local road sign.
Yeah.
I like a fresh install, me personally, but nonetheless.
Entertaining.
I was in until you said maggots.
Informative.
How do you decide who to follow?
Independent.
Oh, aren't they the biggest crock?
You're listening to Tech Talk Radio.
No.
Greetings, everyone. You're listening to Tech Talk Radio. Australia's one weird technology radio show.
Welcome back, wherever you might be listening to us, whether you're listening to us live in New Zealand or on the pod down the track, somewhere anywhere in the world. Welcome aboard. This is Tech Talk Radio, having a bit of a chat about aviation and the technology involved therewith, and especially in lieu of what's happened with the Air France issue over the Atlantic Ocean. So
you might be sitting listening to us on one of the world's many safe and well-maintained streamlined Airbus aircraft.
Well, it is. It's still very much the safest way to transit the world, as we're discussing during the break. Mark was saying that, hey, it's a good time to fly.
Well, as aviation deaths fell last year, I know it's a horrible statistic, but last year there was 502 people killed worldwide, and the year before there was 692. So,
and the new statistic? Oh, sorry, the new one is 500.
502 was 2008.
Yeah.
Yeah, compared to 692.
Safer than a car.
Absolutely much safer than a
car. Much safer. Yeah. So don't feel, don't worry, get on a plane, go for a fly.
I'd still rather get on an A330 than
get in a taxi to drive to the airport.
Yeah. Well, see, you've probably got more chance of being done over in the taxi ride to the airport. Yeah. And not because of the taxi driver, there's things coming at you from all directions. All right. Now, also in the news recently, apart from the, let's talk about Jetstar's little incident. They had an A330 incident, which...
I know.
Why is it all happening to A330s? Is this just because they're out, there's more A330s in the sky than any other?
No, there's a few of them, actually.
Really?
There's about 3,000 or 4,000 737s worldwide, and there's only 600 A330s out there. So it's not a good sign. But I mean, there can be just a coincidence of failures. But this one was a window heater on the right hand side overheated.
Oh, is that what caused it?
Yeah,
there was smoke in the cockpit.
Well, it started
and flames in the cockpit.
Yeah. All the glass windows in the airplane are about, I'm showing my fingers to the camera, about that thick. So probably
that's about 2 inches.
2 inches thick, and they were all heated. Obviously, because we don't have ice, and also it also protects them from being brittle if they do hit anything. Mm-hmm. And the window heater, obviously, in one of these ones on the right-hand side, overheated. And they started to get the smell of smoke and followed by flames. Mm. And we have an in-flight procedure, which would be quite exciting. And it's very simple. The first thing you do is don your oxygen mask. So oxygen mask, regulators on 100%. That's the first two things you do. Crew communication established. That's the first three steps. And these are recall items we call on the checklist. Mm-hmm. And what we do is beside you, each side of the pilot has this little thing, which is a mask in a little box. And it has two little squeezy little yellow tabs. You squeeze those two and pull out. And this thing comes out of this box and expands like a face grabber from Alien. It comes out, seriously, it comes out like that, and you just
visions are flying high here.
And then, and you can see me on camera, you just put it over your face and let go, and it goes like this. And it grips around the back of your head and around the front of your face.
So is that to seal around your face? Instantly,
because we need to be able to have clean oxygen and breathable air within seconds, because if we're passed out or asphyxiated, you're all dead.
I think last time you were in, Mark, you were telling us that the air in the cockpit is fresh air and the air in the cabin is recycled.
It depends on the aircraft, but that can be true.
Okay.
Yeah that's... That has changed in some aircraft updates, but yes, that still can be true.
The other thing that comes to mind, you said 100% oxygen to the pilots.
Yep.
Now, if you've got a fire in the cockpit, the last thing you want is 100% oxygen floating around.
Combustible, really? Isn't
combustible, but we're on 100% because it's just that's what's stored in bottles.
But it's a sealed mask.
It's a very sealed mask.
It's in the face
hugger. That's why some of the and there's contention about this, but one of the thingos is you're not allowed to have beards as a pilot because of the seal.
Yeah.
You've got to keep your moustache with inside, and if you have a goatee, it's got to be with inside. Mm-hmm. But it's got to seal quickly, and it is very fast. And when we do it in the simulator, you've got to get it on quickly because, like these guys, they would have pumped it on, and then the next thing, they grab the extinguisher, and we're going, poof, and then it would have been full of white powder and smoke and flames. Mm. But and then they diverted to Guam, and there was no further incidents.
Now, they did very well in a lot of respects because I think the grabs I saw of the passengers once they got off the aircraft were pretty oblivious
to
the actual situation until they actually hit the ground.
Exactly. Well,
landed on the ground.
You land on the ground, yeah. Good point, yeah. Well, it's a discretion of the captain, but once he's got it contained and you could see there's no further damage, there's no real problem, probably threat to anybody on the airplane. Mm-hmm. However, the airplane probably does need to get on the ground, so he'll divert to his nearest divert point within reason. So to make an announcement that we've had a technical problem at the front, it'd be his discretion whether he wanted to say we had a cockpit fire. That may make people too anxious. So if you said
it would make me very anxious if I heard that.
But if I said to you, folks, we've had a malfunction of one of our window heaters, and unfortunately it's a requirement for it to work, so we're going to have to stop and get it signed. We apologize about this delay and we're going to get it fixed. That's probably what I would say.
Mm-hmm.
Enough information that gives you a reasonable explanation. It's a truth. So when you're reading the newspaper later, you won't be hearing a lie, but I'm not going to worry you unnecessarily. So
ladies and gentlemen, we've managed to put all the flames out now, and
we burnt the toast.
That's right. We've
had the toast. Well, I'm glad you explained that one to me, because I heard on the radio that there were flames coming from the window, and I'm thinking, well, the window isn't something that's going to catch fire. This is someone's obviously got their. Yeah.
It would have been. I mean, I wasn't there, and I didn't see it, but it would have been the window would have been blackened and dirty when they got there. But it probably was in the. I know the area where it is, and you feel them. They're warm, but it would have been in that sort of side area next to. Where we sit.
Yeah, it would have appeared exactly like that. Yeah,
yeah, exactly.
So that would be a very slim chance of something like that happening.
Yes, it would be. I mean, it's not... Coppet fire, it doesn't happen very often, but we have a very set procedures for that. And they could be circuit breakers behind you may have popped, or something else is short-circuited, or you might have spilt your coffee on the control.
I heard on the news that one of the central processing units or a computer in one of the aircraft got so hot it actually caught fire the other day. I don't know whether that's...
I haven't heard
that one. It was one of those things that prick up when you're going and hearing something on the news. I thought, how can that be? But anyway, obviously there's a lot of technology in these aircraft.
The center part of the control is just all computers, as you know, and there's so much heat sink there that there's huge fans and air conditioning to
Do we actually rely too much on technology? Because in the good old days, a pilot used to be able to feel the aircraft. Now,
well, that's true.
Days, you don't.
That's the other thing. The Airbus A330 and compared to what I used to fly, the 737, have a fundamental difference. They're called fly-by-wire. Like you said, there was actually a cable going from my cockpit, from my control column to the vertical stabilizer, enhanced by actuators and hydraulics to make them move.
But it was a physical cable.
It was a physical cable.
If it was vibrating, you'd feel it, wouldn't you?
Yeah, and if you lost all hydraulics, you still could move it with great effort, but you could move it. But these ones, there isn't. There's just a signal going there, and hopefully
it's completely electronic.
Completely electronic. And yes, have we gone too far? No, I don't think so, because I think as long as we keep all the training up and all the extra redundancies, it's safer, because we can land now with zero visibility, with actual zero visibility down to the ground and taxi to the terminal, which, when it's needed, can save lives, because then you'd have to divert to other airframes or make risky approaches, et cetera, et cetera. So it is good.
Well, I guess if pilots or flight crew are incapacitated for whatever reason, you can rely a little bit on the technology to lighten the load in those times of stress.
Well, that's true, yeah. I mean, with a three or two corporate crew, if one does get incapacitated, the automated systems can help a lot for one pilot to fly by himself. Which we actually do in training.
All you've got to do is look at those statistics you were saying earlier, that in fact less people are being killed in airplane accidents. Yeah.
And I don't know. I'll look it up next time, but I'll find out how many people fly a year and how many die.
If we were getting more fly-by-wire aircraft and we were getting more injuries and crashes and people being killed, then you'd say, maybe there's a problem here. But the evidence is there's not.
Yeah. And one of the things they talk about is electromagnetic interference. You probably EMIs.
Yeah.
They're worried about that, like phones and things like that.
Use your mobile phone and crash the plane.
Well, they did a lot of tests with the one from the Qantas one for the ADIRUs, where they actually exposed it to like 17,000 times more the electromagnetic interference than it's tested to, and it still didn't fail. So they're heavily shielded. I mean, anything can happen, as we know. Electrons are electrons running around, but they're heavily shielded.
And yet you say that still the machine that looks at the airspeed and
something still went wrong.
Yeah.
Will go wrong sometime, somewhere.
With this window fire incident, a spokeswoman for Jetstar said that the airline had never experienced any such problem before, and that it was an isolated incident from Jetstar's point of view. They said they're very confident with the fleet that they operate.
Yeah.
They've got very high safety standards. Procedures were followed in this case.
Yes.
And,
I concur with that. I concur that it was a very infrequent thing, and that's handled well. So kudos to them.
The crew did a good job.
Good job, yeah. There's some other interesting things. I was talking to you off air, Andrew, about exit row seats.
Yes. Now, these are the seats that are over the wings where, you know, the hostie or the cabin crew come up and say, do you mind sitting here? Because if we need to and have to open these doors that you're sitting next to, you're it.
Well, they're one of the best seats to sit in, really, from my point of view.
Good for legroom,
but... I know they've actually changed some of the windows. I've noticed in the older ones, you have to pull a lever, pull another lever, then pull the window in, which was very heavy and awkward. The new ones where they're asking people to do it, you only have to pull one lever and it automatically opens out like a...
I, in fact, got asked to sit in one of these on the way up to Sydney just recently.
And you saw the operation's relatively easy now,
and
isn't it?
Yeah. Pull a red lever and it'll just pop open. It goes out.
I was much happier when that came in, but... I'd like to sit next to a window because I obviously know how to get out, and I'll get myself out and say, everyone, please follow me. I'm already out. But the thing I heard, which was a little bit rich, I heard on Business Traveller that Qantas are planning to charge extra for the window seat.
Why?
Exit row seats. Why? Well, what they're saying is, well, you're getting more legroom, so you should pay for it.
Okay. It comes down to a leg, not because you're going to be required in the time Vincent to do a bit of legwork for us.
My opinion is you should get a discount for sitting.
Hang on a minute. Isn't the reason that they ask you if you're prepared to help people and everything, and they put people in those seats so that they can help other passengers if there is an emergency?
Yeah.
That has a direct impact on the number of crew that they're required to have on the plane, doesn't
it? Exactly. So we're actually, by agreeing to help them, you're actually helping them comply with the new regulations to have fewer flight attendants and therefore taking some of their job for them.
And so, not to be outdone, they're now going to charge you for that privilege of them saving money.
Yes, but hang on a minute, Dr. Hang on a minute. Mark, yes. you said you would actually prefer to sit there.
Well, that's
All other things being equal, you'd prefer to sit there.
I would because I'm a ex-pilot, so I know when...
So why wouldn't you pay a little bit extra to sit where you want to sit? you said you wanted to sit there.
Because the airline's already making money out of you sitting there,
I get charging the point of you. But most people, see, the reason I'd say that is because we're supposed to be able to get out of the airplane in 90 seconds. And when most people are not listening to the safety demonstration, or reading, talking and so on, I'm looking around thinking, counting the number of dead bodies I'll have to jump over. Because when something goes wrong, usually it's dark, usually there's smoke, usually you can't see, everyone's scared and screaming and panicking and trying to get out in 90 seconds. If I'm next to the window, or if I'm next to the exit, I know I can get my friends out quickly. Now, so that's why I like to sit there.
Purely selfish reasons.
I'm thinking that selfish reasons. I'm pretty sure Virgin Blue do the same thing. They call it the blue zone seating.
They probably do, yeah.
Blue zone.
Yeah. It just seems rich because, yes, you are getting extra leg room, but as Dr. Ron just said, quite literally, we're asked to work for our seat, so it should be actually be discounted, in my opinion.
That's what they checked, that I was able-bodied. And
you have to be able-bodied. They can't
put a child. Did you do a medical before you popped in there?
Well, I was asked questions about
it. You have to be able-bodied. You can't be you can't be in a wheelchair. You can't be a child. But you
don't
have
to
be old.
You don't have to be an athlete. You don't have to be able to stand up and open a door.
And help others out was the expectation.
Help others out, yeah. But if you've got an arm in a cast or something like that, they wouldn't want you there. Or your mother with a baby, they wouldn't want you there because, you know, you wouldn't be...
Well, you're listening to Tech Talk Radio. The full contingency in this evening. Our guest is Mark Mayer, who is a former airline pilot. He used to fly these things commercially around. We're having a bit of a chat about aviation. I've got a question from Adam Turner, who says, can you ask him about landing at Tulla? Why no instrument landings? He's got the puzzled look in his face.
Yeah, I'm very puzzled.
Okay.
Why no instrument landing?
Yeah, is there a... no? Yes? Maybe? Unknown?
Nearly every landing, there's an instrument landing.
Yeah?
Even in good
weather. What's an instrument landing?
Okay, instrument landing is... instrument landing when you can't see is where you use different instruments to be able to get you in a close proximity to the ground and then land.
Sorry, he's just qualified that with four others. It says fog, fog, fog.
Oh, okay. Now I understand what you mean.
Yeah.
Okay. We are different airports are rated to different levels of visibility. And if you've got fog down to the ground, then we don't have the 0-0, I don't think. I mean, I've been retired for 10 years, so I could be. Mm-hmm. But it'll be coming in anyhow. And places like Heathrow, New York, and places where they have really bad weather, they have the 0-0 landing capability. So the aircraft is qualified to land 0-0.
What's 0-0?
Zero visibility means no distance. I can't see.
So it's just a wall of white that you're flying into?
Wall of white right to the ground. Yep. So no distance vertically, no distance horizontally visibility.
Can't see anything outside the window?
Can't see anything outside the window. Right down to the ground. That's 0-0. Mm-hmm. So no zero visibility and horizontal visibility.
But the computers in the plane can still land the plane safely.
Yes, but there's three prerequisites. The computer of the airplane has to be
rated
for it. Yeah. The aircraft crew have to be trained and rated and current. And the airport has to have the correct instruments to be able to guide it that far.
Right.
So when I was flying, Tullamarine didn't have the 0-0 instruments on the ground.
So this is the instrument landing systems
in the Tullamarine itself didn't.
So if there was very heavy fog, then
we would go do our instrument approach, which would be more likely a ILS instrument landing system, which brings you in a perfect straight line down. We'd get to our minima, which I can't remember them off by heart, which may be 200 or 300 feet. You look out the window. I can't see the runway.
You still can't see the runway?
Go around.
Okay.
Power up.
These new ones, but these new ones, you get to, and we used to practice it with ours, but you get to 200 feet, you'd say 200, then see the auto flare comes in, the green light comes on, it flares by itself. And it just holds it.
Flares means that it tips the nose up. And, yeah,
exactly. And then it just goes boom and lands on the ground. We practiced those in the simulator with 0-0, and it's quite
now,
surreal.
Is it true that these automatic landing systems are so accurate that the nose wheel actually runs over the cat's eyes in the middle of the runway?
Yeah, probably much. Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah, yeah, because it's all, as you know, it's all radio frequency, so it knows exactly where it is, so it runs right down the
center. Down to that sort of accuracy.
Yeah, down to that sort of accuracy. Mm. And we got radio altimeter. So it knows exactly how high it is, not just guessing from pressure sense. It's actually sending out a beam and coming back with an exact height. So it knows when the wheels are 10 feet, 9 feet, 8 feet, 4, 3, 3, 2, 1 foot off. So it knows exactly where it is.
That's fantastic.
So, yeah, it is fantastic.
I love that technology.
Oh, I love that technology too. It's absolutely brilliant.
That's why we need computers in aircraft. I think you've answered my question.
Yeah, that's what I sort of went to before. But, yeah, that's why.
Yeah.
But we don't have that yet, I don't think. So that's why when we have too much fog and you can't see.
When you say we don't have that, is that in specific airports?
Our airport, Tullamarine, doesn't have it. I'm pretty sure.
Maybe Adelaide, maybe Sydney or other airports.
Sydney and Melbourne would be the only two, or maybe Brisbane. Yeah. The other ones, I definitely don't have.
Well, I wouldn't have thought Brisbane would have a fog problem, but I could be wrong because I'm not from up that part of the world.
Some fog sometimes in the morning there in summer. Oh, sorry, winter.
What about Canberra? That's notorious.
That airport's in a swamp.
It is. It's in a swamp and surrounded by hills. It's a horrible airport to go into, especially in bad weather.
There's dinosaurs in bad weather.
I've done it quite a few times, and it was.
Does that have the necessary equipment to do that, like a 0-0 landing?
I don't think it does.
That's why the politicians work there.
I mean, people may correct me, and they can probably Google it faster than I can right now, but those are in other airports, big ones, and they just cost a lot to maintain and set up. We probably will have them eventually. It's just a matter of money.
Yep.
But
yep.
Most modern aircraft can land auto full like that, and we train for it. But not all our airports. Mm. But Australia doesn't need it that much. I mean, that's one of why we have such a wonderful place to fly in Australia, because it's so big, so spread out, so few people, so few airplanes, and
relatively good weather most places. Yeah.
That's just it. If you go to places like Singapore and even London and JFK and those sort of airports around the world, literally, as far as you can see, there's aircraft after aircraft, and they're probably a minute between each.
I don't know what the minimum separation is anymore, but I might be down to 30 seconds.
Oh, so you haven't got much room for error.
Yeah, maybe.
I can remember I was in London fairly recently, Mark, like in the last 12 months, and I was in the city, and I think it was in a motel room, and I was watching the planes go overhead. Obviously, they were there was a particular path that they were taking to come into Heathrow.
Yes.
And, 60 to 90 seconds, on the dot, you could set your watch. Yep. It was just another plane just went past. Nice, yeah. The amount of traffic was incredible.
It is huge. And that's why when we come out here, you see a Tullamarine. One comes in. Okay, peak hour. It's like peak hour.
Yeah, anyway. You wait 5 minutes and then another one comes in.
Yeah. But in those places, it's peak hour 24.
Yeah. And you think there's not much room for error there. Like 60 seconds is not much separation, is it? If something goes wrong on the ground, another one's only 60 seconds behind it, lined up, ready to land.
That's why there's a lot of things to keep, we're watching the radar ground control watches, the traffic control is everyone coordinates. That's why it's beautiful. I mean, it's ballet. It's such complicated ballet. Mm. Aircraft going from here to there and all these things coming together. It is amazing.
On the other hand, though, that puts a lot of pressure on pilots, because if you're coming in and you're 60 seconds behind another plane and there's another plane 60 seconds behind you, don't keep up and you think, I'd better go around.
Yeah.
Then that stuffs up the whole system.
It barely works. They can handle it, but they tell you to speed up. Mm. They'll say, Qantas 5-7,
gives you maximum speed or whatever.
And like you were saying last time, this concept of staying ahead of the numbers and being ahead of where you are.
Yeah, exactly.
If the pilot starts to get behind, that puts a lot of pressure on them, doesn't it?
Yeah, it does. But that's how accidents happen.
Yeah.
if you have a problem, you go around and then start again.
The A380s, have you had a bit of a look-see at those yet?
I've only seen them from a distance. I'm very jealous of the A380s. Yes.
They're very
some of my
big
buddies
aircraft.
I know. One or two of my buddies in my intake course when I was taken in are flying them now. So it's a bit sad. I mean, not to say that I would be on it, but there was obviously a possibility I could have been on them.
You haven't had a guided tour yet from one of your buddies?
No, I haven't had a chance yet, no. But I'll definitely take someone up.
So the A380s can only land in Sydney and Melbourne.
That's because
they're so big. And I think they even renovated the runways in town.
Widen the runways and stuff like that.
But are they really that much faster in the air, or are they just bigger, they carry more people?
So you get the better payload return for your money.
Mm-hmm.
So from an airline point of view.
Yep.
So if you've got two full decks, fill that up, and now the great efficiency of engine fuels and stuff like that, you're basically getting another 200 or 300 people on for the same cost to fly it.
Mm.
I mean, the airplane costs a lot more to build and blah, 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 but the long-term prospect is you'll make more money out of it.
So potentially it's also better for the environment too, because I think aviation is one of those industries that puts more nasty things into the air than anything else, I think, going.
And
really,
the fossil fuel use, as we said last time, like, you know, close to 1 billion litres a day is being burnt. You know, and as I said, like 37,000 years worth of driving a car is burned in one day.
In one day,
So it's pretty sick. It's amazing, isn't it?
Mark, it's been great having you in this evening. We've probably got 5 more minutes to go. Do you want to? You brought in some to end on a lighter note.
Yeah, it's always nice to end on a lighter note, isn't it?
The top 10 of no frills airlines.
I thought. Well, I had a bit of doom and gloom today, and I thought it'd be nice to end up on something aviation with a bit of a smile rather than all the doom and gloom. Because, folks, aviation is a wonderful way to travel, and it is safe.
Absolutely.
And you should enjoy when you fly. So don't fly scared. But if you're flying on a no frills airline, there's a top 10 I found that you know you're flying on a no frills airline if the following.
Here we go.
One, they don't sell tickets, they sell chances. Two, all the insurance machines at the terminal are sold out.
That's a giveaway.
Number three, before the flight, passengers get together and elect a pilot.
Oh.
Number four, you know you're on a cheap one when you cannot board the plane unless you have the exact change.
Yeah, been there.
Before you take off, the stewardess tells you to fasten your Velcro. Seatbelts. Number five, the captain asks passengers all please chip in for the fuel bill. Six.
They virtually do that too.
Yeah, they do. It's called an exercise tax.
That's true, actually. That's not funny.
No, number six.
Well, they pull the steps away. The airplane starts rocking. Number seven, the captain yells to the ground crew to move the cows off the runway. Number eight, the captain you ask the captain how often do their planes crash, and he says just once. on number nine, there's no movie on board. You don't need one. Your life keeps flashing before your eyes.
Oh, dear.
And number 10, if you know you're on no-fill airlines, is that all the planes have a bathroom and a chapel.
Oh, chapel.
I thought that was a lighter note.
It is not, Matt. Thanks very much for having me, Andy.
Excellent. No worries, Mark. It's been great. We've been talking to Mark Mayer this evening, a former commercial airline pilot, all about the instances of, the last moments of the A300 Airbus. Was it A300?
Yeah, it is.
A330 Airbus, the Air France. And a few other interesting things about aviation. Mark, it's been great, and we'll get you back in one day shortly. Hopefully, not because of the next incident.
We'll get you back, not for the wrong reasons.
Yeah. Mm.
Oh, thank you very much. So it was good being here, guys.
You're listening to Tech Talk Radio. We've got a few minutes to go before we close out this evening. Just some other interesting news that sort of popped up during the course of the week. Did any of you guys hear about the Twitter implosion that was going to happen? This was the fact that some bright spark I was reading about. Now, I don't know whether how true it is or anything like that.
But Twitter was going to bring around the end of the world or something the other week, but I don't think it did.
They were calling it the Twitpocalypse.
That's right.
And apparently there was it was a bit like the Y2K bug. Now, we all use Twitter and things like that here, but the Y2K bug, apparently every time Twitter sends out a tweet, it has a unique identifying number, like it's a unique tweet.
Right.
Tweet.
Yep.
Tweet.
It has a unique ID.
Tweet is user, tweet is what it does.
And you can actually, I've noticed, you can copy and paste links to a particular tweet as well, if you find that number. Yeah, there's a format. There's syntax that you can get right, and you can actually refer people to a specific tweet in your timeline.
Okay, well, anyway, this identifier that we speak of has about to hit a very large number, 2,147,483,647.
It's a lot of tweets.
It'll be 2 to the power of something.
Yeah. Now, this number is the signed integer limit, and apparently when some third-party Twitter clients start hitting it, the identifiers will start turning negative.
Oh, that makes sense. And they're using integer variables instead of longs or whatever they need to use.
Anyway, apparently the applications were going to crash.
Right, but nothing did.
Nothing seems to have happened at the moment. But I just thought, isn't it amazing that we can now, seriously, in 2009, talk up the end of Twitter as we know it because of some Y2K-related type sort of issue?
It's people making the same mistakes over and over again.
Yep.
So, you know, really.
The types of variables they're using in their code are just designed to save memory. Yep. And if you skimp on memory, this is what happens.
Absolutely. In another interesting thing last week, we had a caller ring in and say, with the proliferation of Macintosh viruses, which are starting to creep onto the scene, is there any antivirus sort of software available for Macs? And JD was off camping last week, so we couldn't actually ask him. But he's sitting here in the studio tonight. And I guess just as a PC sort of person, JD, since they moved into the Intel platform, you would have thought that this would be a sort of inevitable sort of dilemma where viruses would start creeping into the operating system of a Mac. Is there a virus package?
Oh, yes, there certainly has been. Yeah. Since OS X's been out, there's always been virus packages, and there's certainly some around. I actually don't use any.
Yeah.
But then I'm not using my machine isn't for commercial purposes, it's for home use, and I'm reasonably smart about what I download and what I use and that sort of thing. So,
but even a home user on a PC wouldn't be without antivirus these days, so that's still a big difference between the Mac and the PC world.
I think it's a different mindset, though, isn't it? Because traditionally Mac users have been, you know, sort of oblivious because of their, and I don't mean to sound derogatory, but because it's been a minority operating system, any hacker worth their weight in gold would be targeting the majority system.
Yeah, look, it's probably an interesting thing to track, because if you go back to the old Mac OS prior to OS X and all its Unix goodness, there was lots of viruses around for the old Macintosh operating system, and it was, you know, probably much more popular in the 80s when the Macs first came out. With the move to OS X and Unix as an underpinning, it's a bit more secure, so it's actually harder to get stuff into it. You know, you have to actually be an administrator to load stuff in that's going to cause lots and lots of damage. Having said that, worms and trojans and so forth can usually find a way around that. But yes, there are virus packages. I don't use any. I can find some and put them on.
Maybe we'll talk about next week. When we come in next week. All right, you're listening to Tech Talk Radio, Oddspot Gadget website of the week. After this,
suffering suck attack. This has to be the best technology show on the internet. Tech Talk Radio.
Let's face it, Telstra has a huge PR problem.
It's called the Integrated Public Number Database.
Hopefully that's not what they're talking about.
No. Do you block them, do you?
I do.
Yeah, this is what happened, yeah.
This is what happened.
Yeah.
Look at that.
Yep.
Good use of technology.
Adam, you're too far gone to be saved now.
Entertaining.
How can you work in IT and not drink coffee?
Informative.
Boffany, techie propeller head, Vicky.
Independent.
The SMS is not an on-time delivery system.
You're listening to Tech Talk Radio.
And if you get Inga from Sweden showing her wares.
In this house, we obey the laws of thermodynamics.
Tech Talk Radio's Gadget of the Week.
Former Tech Talk Radio panellist Mark Diggins.
I remember him. G'day, Mark.
Has introduced the Gadget of the Week today as being the Magic Jack. For more information, you go to magicjack.com. Mark says, I bought one of these from Radio Shack and thought it might be a good Gadget of the Week.
Radio Shack?
It's a nifty, yeah, it's a nifty voice over IP adapter. With a USB plug on one end and a telephone socket in the other end. So just like a voice over IP gateway, but you plug it into the USB port on your laptop or your computer and you connect the telephone handset and you start dialing. Mark says it costs $40 for the first year and $20 for every year thereafter, but it's unlimited calls to unlimited destinations, mobile, international, local. He said his early impressions of it are that the voice quality is excellent. There are some initial problems with all calls going to voicemail. An upgrade of the software and some changes to my security settings seem to fix this. He's had some calls drop out after about 5 to 15 minutes of talk time. Hasn't had time to investigate yet, not giving out the number to anyone until all is well. He likes getting the email with the .wav file as these voicemail messages. Mm-hmm. Yeah, so that's some feedback from Mark. I've got some reservations.
Might have to get him to bring a few home, do you think?
But potentially. I've got some reservations about driving an analog telephone handset with whatever power is available to you on a USB port. But he said it seems to work. So have a look. It might be what you're looking for. The Magic Jack.
Here it is, everybody. The world's greatest website.
Tech Talk Radio website of the week.
And time for the Tech Talk Radio website of the week. This one in particular is a Google website for no other reason than it's potentially going to revolutionize the way people deal with Microsoft Office. And this week, Google have released Apps Sync for Outlook. So if you're an Outlook user, this will sync all your good stuff with the cloud. Mm. Now, there's been other programs that have come before this, and there will no doubt be other programs that will come after this. But this is the current one that Google's got going. And it's basically, they're now gunning for Exchange, really, is where it comes down to. And you can actually, you know, share and sync and do all those sort of things with your PDA from your Outlook through the cloud. And if you want to have a bit of a bash at it, it's at wgoogle.com/apps/get-outlook-sync. So, yeah, it's very new. Haven't tested it yet, but I reckon it's got to be worth a go, because especially if you're out there in the field.
Google's had an application to allow you to upload from Outlook to Google, so this must go the other way.
Yeah, yeah. Ooh. I must admit, I sync things through, like there's like individual apps for different sorts of things, like there's Calendar Sync, there's Contact Sync through your Gmail clients and things like that, and they all tend to work relatively well between, you know, like say if someone rings you on your mobile and you bookmark them or you grab their number and next thing you know it appears in your Outlook contacts because you can do all that sort of stuff. But this hopefully is going to streamline that and pull it all together under the one auspice of cloud computing, really.
Very so, nice. Yeah,
so have a check it out. It just got released this week. Google Apps for, App Sync for Outlook, available from a Google site near you.
In beta?
Oh, look, no doubt.
There is a fine line between genius and madness.
Missed it by that much.
I know nothing. Nothing.
Don't ask! For God's sakes, don't ask!
Houston, we have a problem.
The Odd Spot on Tech Talk Radio.
In line with our aviation technology
you had
discussion
to, didn't you,
tonight,
Dr. Wright?
An Air India passenger jet heading to Frankfurt has been forced to return to Mumbai after a bag of curry powder set off smoke and fire alarms. Pilots on the Boeing, for a change, we're not bagging Airbus anymore, 747-400, activated fire extinguishers after receiving a cockpit warning about a fire in the cargo hold, according to
and
the
this
Mumbai
is
Mirror.
Spices that did this, wasn't
but
it?
But on the plane's return to India's financial and entertainment capital, engineers said the alert had been triggered by the escape of particles from a bag containing 2 to 3 kilograms of curry powder.
Must have been a hot curry.
It was a hot curry. The bag belonging to a passenger from the western Indian state of Gujarat was removed before the plane took off again after a 12-hour delay.
Fantastic.
Mangoes and meat products that generate heat have been suspected of causing similar incidents on Air India flights in the past, according to the newspaper.
Oh, very good. Well, there you go. You heard it first here on Tech Talk Radio. Next week, would you like to know what we've got next week? In our remaining few seconds, we're going to be talking about digital radio.
Again? Oh, DAB and DAB Plus.
DAB and DAB Plus. If you want to know what the difference is, next week is the time to tune
and the
in.
The ABC are starting broadcasting in a couple of weeks.
Oh, absolutely. I did ABC this morning talking about it. It was a lot of fun.
Is Tech Talk going out on DAB Plus?
Oh, look, maybe.
Not yet.
Not in the foreseeable future.
Oh.
All right, that's Tech Talk Radio for this week. Thank you, everyone, for tuning in. We apologies about the chat. It was running a tad slow tonight due to our ISP, so hopefully that'll rectify itself next week. Very big thanks to Mark Mayer coming in and telling us all about aviation. Very interesting topics this evening on the Airbuses and things like that. So we'll wait and see what happens. Hopefully they'll stay in the sky and we might find that black box device that we spoke of earlier. So anyway, until next week, it's bye for now.
You've been listening to Tech Talk Radio, brought to you each and every week by a group of dedicated professionals from within the media, broadcasting, IT and telecommunications industries. The team consists of executive producer Andrew McComb, producer Dr. Ron, panellists Justin Dunlop, Graham Callaghan and Mark Diggins, expert opinion from Adam Turner, and our US correspondent is Lydia Davis. Post-production facilities courtesy of Evolving Communications, podcast production by Graham Callaghan. Tech Talk Radio is broadcast, recorded and streamed live to the world each and every Monday night at 8 p.m. from the studios of 3WBC. The crew wish to thank all the stations around Australia that take the show. Tech Talk Radio is available for syndication on your local station. For sponsorship and advertising, call 03 9818 2756 or visit our website techtalkradio.com.au for more information. This has been a production of Tech Talk Radio Vic and is subject to copyright and applicable laws and may not be rebroadcast without approval.